happiness does not depend on riches. Poor men are often happy.
In theory, yes, but not in reality. Take my case, for instance. My mother, my two sisters, my little brother, and I must all live somehow on my salary of 23 rubles a month. We have to eat and drink, I take it. You wouldn't have us go without tea and sugar, would you? Or tobacco? Answer me that if you can.
The play will soon begin.
Well, from the very beginning of his play, The Seagull, Anton Chekhov blurs the line between reality and illusion. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In a short lifetime, Chekhov went a long way to bring Russian drama, world drama for that matter, into the 20th century. How well understood were his plays in his own time? How well did Chekhov get along with the directors of his plays? What effect did he have on acting? And what about those second acts where nothing much seems to happen? Our guest is Anatoly Smelyansky, Associate Artistic Director of the Moscow Art Theater and head of the Moscow Art Theater School.
Oh, welcome to University of the Year. It's nice to have you here. Each of the great dramatists like O'Neill or Ibsen or Shakespeare has a voice, has a style, has an importance in drama. And if, as we're turning to think about Chekhov, can you give me some sense of what you think his importance is?
I will try. You know, it's interesting that scholars are very different because of the what kind of writers they are studying. the scholars who are studying Gorky is very different from the scholars who are studying Chekhov.
You mean it's a different personality that's attracted to a certain
because
writer?
The subject affects you, you know. If your whole life, you know, in a shallow water, it's one thing. If your whole life in Chekhov's ocean, it's a little bit different. So, and some one of them wrote probably very clever, at least I like it, about Chekhov, that the difference is the new drama, the Chekhovian drama. The difference is that actually old-fashioned drama or conventional drama, drama of the 19th century, it's about drama in life. In Chekhov's case, it's drama of life, which is completely different. This is probably true. Not something dramatical in life, which is actually the usual trivial understanding of drama, but drama of life itself, where actually you don't have enemies. If you would look at all of the major, most important Chekhov's plays, who are the enemies of the good people? Actually, it's not clear. Actually, generally speaking, you should say life itself. They are struggling with life.
Was that a problem in Chekhov's time, or even today for that matter, trying to look for some action on stage, and instead you get everybody thinking or talking?
The problem is that Chekhov, I think, changed the measure, the understanding, what does it mean, action on stage. Actually, because we used to have that action, which means that someone is jealous, someone is kills, you know, the enemy, someone is a bankrupt, someone is merry, or at the end of a play commits suicide. So all of that stuff, Chekhov actually passed through all of that things. In his first play, unknown play, so-called, he wrote it when he was a teenager, actually started. There is a lot of, you know, that's trivial stuff. In Ivanov, by the way, the hero, the Ivanov, kills himself on the spot at the end of the play, kills himself. And it's so expressive and so on. Never Chekhov will use it. Nobody kills himself in his play. In The Seagull, he starts that. Look, at the end of a play, a hero commits suicide, but off stage, which
yes.
is absolutely anti-theatrical, but deliberately done, of course. And at the end of a play, we could hear the gun, but we don't see the hero who kills himself. And someone came on the stage and said, Konstantin Gavrilovich shot himself.
Well, that sounds Greek to me. Was Chekhov aware of Sophocles?
Of course, it's a kind of a parody, but in the contemporary life, someone is coming and said, oh, Konstantin Gavrilovich killed himself, you know, or shot himself. And then in Uncle Vanya, it's a parody on a shooting scene because it's in the middle of a play and it's unsuccessful attempt to kill the enemy because there is no enemy. That's the point. And in The Three Sisters also, Baron Tuzenbach goes on duel, and he killed there, but it's not on stage. In The Cherry Orchard, there is no suicide, there is no shooting scene, nobody kills himself, but this is the most, you know, dark and pessimistic play of him.
And do you think that, aside from the Russian language that these plays and also his short stories are written in, do you think that there are characteristics that you see in Chekhov's writing that are unmistakably Russian? And if so, how can you, even in another language, you look at this play or you read a short story and you know this is a Russian work?
Definitely unmistakably Russian, but in a way, you know, it's the most difficult thing to define. What does it mean, Russianness, Americanisms, or French or English? We feel it like a smell of flower, mostly. And everything is in the language. In the language which reflects the mentality of the nation, climate of the country, hundreds of thousands of years, the way people lived it, and so on and so on. And look, for Chekhov himself, I would say that for every writer in the world, to define his own voice, not like Russian voice, but to define himself, it means to make a position of yourself into the nation, in the climate, in the space, in the time, and everywhere. And Chekhov was trying to understand, you know, he started as a writer of a humoristic short stories, and he did not have his own name. He signed it Antosha Chekhonte, not Anton Chekhov. You could not be a serious writer in Russia, in a country where they have a Dostoevsky and Tolstoy with the last name Antosha Chekhonte. So he was thinking about how to get his real name, his own name, Anton Chekhov. And the first piece of art which he did and was recognized as a serious Russian writer was his short story called The Steppe, The Desert, which is about a boy, very lyrical, who is traveling through the steppe to visit his relatives and meeting different people in a Russian steppe, which is, for the first time, Chekhov gave that Russian unmanageable space, kind of a fairy tale. And this is, for the first time, it's a serious Russian writer. Because of what? Russian voice, Russian understanding. You know, we are different because, not that we are deliberate, we are different, we are human beings, but we are different because I grew up on a river there, and I was drinking in my childhood, you know, that kind of stuff, and I was eating that kind of stuff, and I was breathing with different air, and so on and so on. And because Chekhov is a boy from the southern part of Russia, from Taganrog, and I've never been there, and 25 years ago, for the first time, Moscow Art Theater was a kind of a jubilee of Chekhov. And we went to show the Three Sisters in Taganrog. And they brought us by the military aircraft because the town was locked. It's a military town in the Soviet time. So, and they brought us to Taganrog. And the first amazement, from Chekhov's short stories and from his plays like Three Sisters, Chekhov's world is quite gloomy, fences, gray, everything is in gray. It's a provincial, dull, boring life. But that's probably the point to answer your question. When we came to Taganrog, which is very important because for any writer, Faulkner or Chekhov, where you grow up, Midwest gives, it's a kind of a Taganrog and the steppe, the desert there. Midwest, which gives the voice for so many great writers and so on because it's space. This is very important to establish your voice and understanding of your country and so on. And I came to Taganrog, and from Chekhov's stories, I thought that Taganrog is a quite, you know, unpleasant town. It is an unpleasant town, I would say. Still, it's the same town like 100 years ago. Nothing changed, at least 25 years ago. But the point was, yes, this is the Chekhov's house, which father became a bankrupt. They sold it. It was sold, and they could not pay off and so on. It's a story which would affect whole life of Chekhov. In every play is a bankruptcy, home, house, problem, issue of house. Negative meaning of the house, because house enslaves you. Americans know what does it mean, you know, you have to pay all your life. And I came to see the place where he was born and he spent years of his life. Yes, it's a very boring, dirty street and the same. But I was amazed that just go around the corner and look what is there. There is the Azov Sea. There is the vista of the sea. And I did not feel that Chekhov is a boy from the sea. And this is the important thing. Yes, this is Russia with that unmanageable space, the steppe, the desert, and all of that. But at the same time, it's a vista of a future, of something unbelievably interesting, attractive, and so on and so on. You know, when they, in the Moscow Art Theater, when they started doing the Cherry Orchard and came to the second act, which is, as you said, the most difficult in the rehearsal because nothing happens. In the second. It's a very Chekhovian special poetry of the second act in each play where nothing really happens. And Stanislavski actually said to him, Anton Pavlovich, I don't know how should I direct that nothing to do in this. Because theater is about action, action, action. There is no action. But there is another kind of action, which theater goers did not understand before Chekhov. And actually he taught Russian audience, and now I would say world audience, to understand that actually human life are not in actions. The most important things in our life happened in a silence, within ourselves. And so how to reveal it on stage? In the poses, in musicality, in a special way of acting when the great actors and the great acting is not when you are speaking monologues. You know, Russian way of 19th century way of acting. You have a great part? Yes, I have a great part. Why? I have five great monologues. That's the evaluation of a great part. What are you doing between the monologues? I'm waiting for my turn.
Yeah.
Chekhovian way of acting is completely different because great acting is in the silence. How you manage to be silent? How you are acting in that moment? And so on. So during that rehearsal of the second act of the Cherry Orchard, Nemirovich, who was one of the directors of the show and partner of Stanislavski and personal friend of Chekhov, they asked him, could you advise us what would be good for you, what kind of set design you see for the second act, which is so difficult? And Chekhov, in his usual manner of irony and humor, said, I don't know, I'm not a set designer, you are professionals, you know much better than I. But if you're asking me, I would say that I need, in the second act, where nothing happens, and miserable people talking about nothing. Look, he says, probably I would like to have in the second act, which is the off-house, the play, it's in a field. I need endlessly, as a backdrop for the second act, endlessly dazzling vista. Which is for me, I would say, image of his poetry, of his world. Yes, the subject matter of all of the plays and stories and so on, like, he had a beautiful masterpiece called Our Ordinary Story. It's about life, actually. It's beautiful, one of most beautiful, highest level of his prose. And yes, the subject matter is ordinary story, which is human life. From the point of view of universe, it's a very ordinary story. Who interested in the human life in the whole universe? It's like invisible insect. We are not more important than the mosquitoes for the universe because universe and nature is neutral. And Chekhov's philosophy and his understanding of the human life, we are part of a nature. That's it. And there is no morality, there is no, you know, even God is a big question for him. A big question because his faith was ruined by his father, dark son of a slave. Chekhov is a grandchild, grandson of a serf, of a slave. That's what kind of life, you know. And the subject matter, I would like to repeat it, the image of that endlessly dazzling vista. Subject matter is ordinary life, daily life, humdrum life, but I need a frame of eternity. Our life, miserable life, but in the frame of eternity. This is the new dramatic painting. This is the new way of presenting, you know, what does it mean, action or, you know, on stage. The whole issue is how to live your life, how to spend your life, how to be within the time.
Well, what aspects of Chekhov's own life, growing up in 19th century Russia as someone from the class that would have been considered the serf class back a few generations and so on, what other aspects of his own life besides the bankruptcy, besides the town that he grew up in, what other aspects of his personal experience do you think are important for us to know about in terms of his relationships with women, his mother, his personality?
I think everything is important. And unfortunately, for many decades, the Russian, first of all, Soviet scholars, they did not go in depth in the Chekhov's personal life because of many reasons, not only in Russia, but in many countries. We have some kind of inner restrictions when we're talking about great guys, about great writers. We are reluctant to talk about very personal issues, what kind of sexuality, what kind of stuff, you know. Yes, Oscar Wilde, you know, Wilde. But in Chekhov's case, many things were not clear. Now we have one of the recent books on Chekhov written by Donald Reifeld, English scholar. It was translated into Russian, and it shocked the society because Donald Reifeld came in the 90s when the Russian archives became open for the foreigners. And he collected, with the guidance of some Russian people, I know them, he got the whole collection of what you call, what's the English word, rough? On your face you have
warts?
Some. Warts.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, yes.
He collected all of the warts of Chekhov's life. It's a collection of that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he gave incredible documentary footage, materials, to understand in depth Chekhov's personality and the idea, which everybody knows about Chekhov, that this is a guy who liberated himself, and this kind of liberation, this is in the literature where before Chekhov you have Lev Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Gogol and Pushkin and the whole phenomenon of the 19th century Russian literature. But even on the top of that literature, on the end of the century, you have a writer really liberated himself. What does it mean, liberated himself? When you know his personal life, really, from the childhood, horrible childhood, you know, and...
How so?
What kind of lower depths in the beginning and what kind of liberation and free mind, free out of any kind of restrictions, of any kind of prejudice, including religious, by the way, which is quite hard issue, but we can discuss it. All kind of issues. Issue of anti-Semitism, because he's a boy from the southern part of Russia, where anti-Semitism is a part of life. It's a nutrition. It's not like, oh, something. No, it's a part of life. How he liberated himself from that? He started as a usual boy in the southern part of Russia. He ended as a guy who rejected, you know, the Dreyfus case and, you know, cut his relationship with many friends because he could not accept that kind of racism and idiotic, you know. But even in a very personal, I would say, things like sexuality and so on, also, we never discussed it because... It's kind of a liberal censorship, you know, and does not allow us to... No. Chekhov is so delicate, so intelligent. Why you should discuss, you know, his sexuality? He did discuss it in hundreds of letters. He did discuss sex and his relation with many women in his life. And, by the way, Donald Reifeld gave the whole scale of that. And, you know, some of the Russian scholars saying he disgraced Chekhov, he is anti-Russian, he doesn't love Russia, he wants to kill our everything. No, he doesn't want to kill our everything. And actually, I would say, after his book, whereas that collection of the, how you call the
words.
The words collection, I respect Chekhov and I love him more than I would not read that book. We do have in Russia probably two great writers who were balanced. I would say Pushkin and Chekhov, beginning of great Russian literature and the end of the 19th century. Two great liberated, absolutely liberated Russian writers, but balanced without extreme. And Chekhov looked at the Russian psychology and said, you know, in Russia, people are, they have a kind of a dilemma. God exists, God does not exist. You should believe, you must believe, you cannot believe. But the whole point is not between, you know, God does exist, God does not exist. The point is that in the space between God exists and he does not exist, and you have to get through that distance between no and yes. And this is the human life. And he made his journey from no to yes in some level. That's the point. And nobody could repeat it because Tolstoy did not have that experience because only yes, tragedy of that, yes. But Chekhov is completely different things.
When I think of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, I think not so much humor running through their works. When I think of Pushkin and Chekhov, I think of a balance of seriousness and humor.
Yes, and look, Pushkin's definition about happiness. We started from that when we are happy, rich or when we're poor. Pushkin's beautiful definition, I don't trust in happiness. About the issue of happiness, I'm the atheist. I don't believe in that, in happiness. The last definition of Pushkin and his poetry about the ideal of the human soul, of the human life. На свете счастья нет, но есть покой и воля. There is no happiness in the world but peace and freedom instead of happiness. I would say Chekhov probably would repeat it. peace and freedom instead of happiness, which gives the, I would say, ideal situation for the human being. Peace and freedom.
And do you think Chekhov's medical training, didn't he get trained as a potential doctor? Did that change the way he saw humanity?
Partly, definitely.
Help him see the wards.
Because actually this is the approach of a professional doctor. And many times in his life he denied that he's a writer. And so I'm a doctor. And my goal is to get the right diagnosis. And he died in the same way, you know. His last sentence he said before he died in German, Ich sterbe, I am dying. It's a diagnosis. It's not about God, about devil, about, you know, I am dying. This is a fact. You can interpret that. And before that, actually also, on the top of diagnosis, he's not just a doctor, he's a great writer. On the top of the diagnosis, a minute before his death, he did ask a glass of champagne. And emptied the glass and said, "Ah, I did not have champagne for a long time." Then, Ich sterbe, I am dying.
He was in Germany at the time.
In Germany, he was in Baden-Wader in the small spa in Germany. I am dying. I don't know. For me, it's very important. You know, in the Russian mythology, every country has a mythology about great writers, how the great guys are dying, what's the way, what did they say before they died. It's very important, the last words. You know, in Russian mythology, it's so important. Pushkin, he was killed in a duel, and he was dying about 3 days. And the last sentence, the last phrase was, he asked his doctor, his friend, Dr. Dahl, can you get me a little bit higher? I need an air. Mm-hmm. And for us, the whole poetry of Pushkin, sunny and I need an air. Get me a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. O'Gogol, who died when he was 43, stopped eating, you know, the Russian fanaticism, and was skinny like a boy, and burned down the Dead Souls, his great poem, you know, and everything destroyed him, the dark religious, you know, stuff. All his life was looking for God, and the best way to get to the highest, you know. And finally, before he was completely out of mind, but the last sentence of Gogol is, can I get a ladder? Where you are going? Which is, for all of Russians, for the rest of the times, would be, Gogol asked a ladder. Well, Chekhov did not ask a ladder. Can I get a glass of champagne? Which is, when we are asking about Russianness, Russianness is Gogol who is asking a ladder. Russianness is Tolstoy who died in the middle of the road, you know, with a Bible in his, it's time to go. And Russianness is in Chekhov's desire to get a glass of champagne and to make a right diagnosis. I am dying. That's it, which is the beginning of the whole 20th century experience. We don't know, exist or not, but you have to face your life and you have to make your choice. Chekhov never used the philosophical definitions like existentialism or like that, but it's very close to what we call the existentialism. Every day a choice. And if you even don't believe, if you don't have a faith, it doesn't make your life easier, just opposite. Because if you have a faith and belief, it's easier. If you don't have, and if you Chekhov, if you really face the human problems, all of them, it's so difficult to keep that position without any faith, without any hope that there is a next life, and after the champagne, something great expects you. Who knows? Nobody came from there back. Never.
Well, we'll come back with more about Anton Chekhov and his plays in just a moment. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Anatoly Smelyansky. We're talking about the great Russian playwright and short story writer Anton Chekhov, who did so much to reinvent the theater. But that comes with a risk, doesn't it?
Yes, and The Seagull is his first and symbolic play, is probably the most important, just to understand what he actually did. In a letter to his friend, he was joking when he was creating The Seagull. I'm doing a comedy, I'm writing a comedy against all of the tenets of contemporary art. In my play, nothing happens, only talks, and 5 tons of love. Of course, it's against the all of the conventional drama of the 19th century. And he did it consciously, deliberately, trying to get the experience of him as a prose writer to the theater, to the stage. Actually, it's very interesting, that connection between prose writing and playwriting. Usually, it's a very different gift, I would say. If you're a prose writer, It's a very rare case in the world literature that the prose writer becomes a great playwright. No. Look at Dostoevsky. Very theatrical. You know, every novel is you can adapt it hundreds of times because it's so great and so intense, and the plot is, drives you and so on. But never did the play. When he was asked to do the adaptation of The Crime and Punishment, said, no. No way for me. I'm a prose writer. If you would like to adapt my novel, you have to choose only probably one line of that and to make a play, because the play is artistically, from the point of view of the idea, artistic idea, is completely different from what I was wrote in my prose. You have to create, if you would like to adapt my prose, you have to create, to produce a new artistic idea for your play, which is actually provision in the 20th century theater when we are adapting Dostoevsky or Tolstoy. Of course, we are creating. Chekhov, like Mikhail Bulgakov, another great doctor in the Russian literature, who followed Chekhov in the 20s and 30s. It's a very rare case of a playwright and prose writer together. Bulgakov was joking about that when he was asked, what about playwriting and prose writing? How you could do it together? He says, it's like two hands of the piano player. I cannot separate it. This is a very rare case. And he brought that experience of prose writing, what kind of experience, to the theater. I would say this is the experience of paying attention to the life which was unknown for the arts. What kind of life? You know, when Stanislavski started thinking about The Seagull, actually his first reaction was, it's not a play, I cannot do it. It's never discussed, but actually in My Life in Art, Stanislavski is talking about that. My first response was, it's not a play, I can't do it. He was convinced by his friend Nemirovich, go to the countryside, study it, be ready to study. But I promised him. Chekhov did not allow Moscow Art Theater to stage it because that experience with the imperial stage was so horrible and horrifying. And his sister asked Moscow Art Theater, don't touch the play. It's a young company, unknown actors. What you can do with that? It was a failure on imperial stage with the best actors. He is mortally sick. Don't hurt him. And finally, Nemirovich convinced him, no, we will do, you will see that you are a great playwright. I will confirm your status as a playwright for the whole country. And finally, Chekhov said, he have not seen the opening night. He did not come. He came in a few months, actually. In a few months, he was afraid of that negative, that he would not like it. And his ego, he's a very, strong man. And he didn't come for the opening night. And Stanislavski, when he came to the countryside and started doing so-called prompt book, you call it prompt book, the director's book, some, on the margins of the play, some comments of director, how it should be on stage. The profession of a director did not exist that time.
Did it not?
In the 19th century, who is a director? Is a playwright or an actor? There is no special super profession of the 20th century theater, which is Stanislavski started together with Chekhov, by the way. His drama provoked the appearance of the most important theater profession of the 20th century theater, which is director's theater by definition. If you don't have great directors like now in America or in Russia even now, there is no theater. In a way of the 20th century theater, when you had Meyerhold and Stanislavski and Taïrov and Brecht and Streller and Bruch and so on and so on.
When The Seagull did sort of flop when it first was produced, that must have been very hard for Chekhov. I've seen some letters that he's written where he's so doubtful of his talent. He writes in one, this is a letter from 1886, I felt that I did have talent, but I had got used to thinking it insignificant. All those who are near to me have always treated my writing with condescension and have never stopped advising me in a friendly manner not to give up real work for scribbling.
Yes. But, he had so high self-estimation. And when he's saying about that, it doesn't mean that he did not understand. He had incredible gift for playwriting, incredible new understanding of theater. But it was a failure. And next step was the Ivanov in 87, when he finally did first so-called serious play. Chekhov is actually 8 years later. And let me finish that short story about Stanislavski. When he started writing the prompt book, and he started interpreting the first stage direction of Chekhov, which is the lake there, and they are starting doing a play. Young girl from, she's somewhere there from the lake. The parents don't allow her to be there, but she came finally. She's late, and the young playwright, Konstantin Treplev, kind of a genius, avant-garde playwright, he is preparing to start the play, 8 o'clock p.m., sharply, even. and it's important for him. And Stanislavski started thinking about the first stage direction. So, you know, directing starts when you are thinking about the first stage direction. It's a playwright's stage. It's not director's stage. It's a Chekhov's. But Stanislavski started thinking, okay, this is the lake. Should I put the lake on stage? You know, what I should, what kind of sounds? Chekhov did not tell him what kind of, you know, atmosphere, what kind of things. And Stanislavski started imagining, making his improvisation about, okay, it's Russia, it's sunset, it's a warm summer day somewhere in the province in the central Russia, probably a lot of mosquitoes. Now probably it's a provincial Russia. It should be like someone, a drunken man is singing very sad song. I could not imagine Russia, Russian summer day without that drunk man who is singing something and so on. And finally, in a few lines, just using, he got to the point of the whole poetry of Chekhov. I have to create a score of the boredom of the provincial life. Score like for the orchestra, for the symphony, to make a score to discover on stage, which is absolutely new goal for the theater, to discover the boredom and poetry of the provincial life.
That's got to be the hardest thing to do dramatically, to create boredom.
Yes, yes. And this is the second act that nothing to do in this and so on. How to create it? And all of the means of so-called director's theater they invented, it's about that. How to present boredom of life, or I would say real life, where actually not much happens. If in the body of the events of the world, you know, yes, of course, you're starting your day in the morning with, like me today, with CNN, what happens in Iran, what happens in Iraq. But actually, in 95% of the human lives, nothing happened. I just slept, or I was sleeping well or not well. That's it. Nobody cares about, you know, what is going on with 95% of the mankind. It's about their life. No, it's not about. It's about few people, about kings and queens and princesses and so on. No, it's about, you know, ordinary life of ordinary people. And that life is very dramatical and very theatrical. That's what one of the Russian critics said. Not drama in life, but drama of life.
What about the politics of life? If you look at plays like Seagull, Uncle Vanya, Cherry Orchard, Three Sisters, even if they're not about czars directly or about, you know, how does the political view of Chekhov somehow get across on stage? Or does
also,
it not?
No, it's an interesting question because actually Chekhov is, if you look at his dramas, it's a complete detachment from any political issues. Sometimes people would say something, but I don't remember even real political issues in his plays. It means that he was not interested or he was completely neutral. No. But his doctor's point of view, you know, politics is a small, small part of life, which is important sometimes. And they decide your life. They kill you. They allow you to be alive and so. But it's a very small part of life, and Chekhov did not pay a lot of attention to that, but he was not neutral. And I did tell you that in his liberation, self-liberation, he did a lot of steps about that anti-Semitism and all of that things. And his ideal, his state of mind, his understanding of human being is full and complete absolute freedom. Of course it means, you know, in Russia, end of the century. Of course, end of the century. What is end of the century in Russia and when Chekhov grew up? It's comparatively Anna Akhmatov, the great Russian poet, in the 50s, looking back in the 30s, the bloodiest time of Stalin, she said. But in beginning of the 30s was okay. It was a vegetarian time. Vegetarian time without blood, you know. End of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century is really vegetarian time for Russia. It's a very few years in the whole history of this country. Actually, when the Russian intellectuals, and like Chekhov, you know, they feel it's okay. It's okay. Yes, there is a Russian Tsar, but who cares, you know? There is Leo Tolstoy, he's alive. He's more important than Russian Tsar. You know what? The end of the century, in 1896, the last Russian emperor, Nicholas II, came to power. It was a coronation day. I will tell you some probably you don't know, and the listeners would probably, it's interesting when I am. When Nicholas II came to power, and it was the coronation day in Moscow, it was a great stampede. They killed a lot of thousands of people because they could not police the situation. Millions of people came to see the young emperor, you know, and so on. Next day, when after that stampede in Moscow, Leo Tolstoy, who was in Yasnaya Polyana, 300 kilometers from Moscow, the second Russian Tsar, who was an old man, and he decided to send a letter to Nicholas II. It's a beautiful letter of a Russian writer. Without that, you would not understand what does it mean Russia and what does it mean a status of a great Russian writer, which is more important than a president of the country, than Tsar, the monarch, or general secretary of the Communist Party. So Tolstoy, the letter is, of course, he was thinking how to start the letter, you know, but actually there is a ritual. If you are addressing to the Tsar, to the king, it's no problem, because from the stock, you can, you know, your majesty and so on. And so on. You cannot say, hi, guy, or it's a Tsar. It's a Tsar. Look how he started his letter. I probably Chekhov would love it. Young man, what are you doing? This is, I would say, pure Christian definition. You are young man, I am old man. And I am talking to you like old man could talk to the young. Young man, what are you doing? How did you start your deal, your term? How did you start it? And in Chekhov's case, many times he was disgusted with, you know, Russian bureaucracy. He knew that. But again, it's incredible objectivity in him. It's not just like, I am very politically agitated, you know, I will talk about Russian Tsar, Russian police. He knows that Russian Tsar and Russian monarchy and Russian police and Russian bureaucracy and Russian corruption and everything which you have now, the same, it's a part of a Russian life, of Russian mentality, because that psychology of slaves, of slavery, it's not like you can get rid of it just in a moment. He knew the process. You know, there is a very famous in Russia stuff. Chekhov was asked by one of his correspondents, give me a plot for a good story, for a short story. And he said, oh, it would be a good plot if you will take it. A boy who was beaten over the head all his childhood, and then the rest of his life is trying to squeeze the slave out drop by drop.
Sounds it's like about, Chekhov. Mm-hmm.
It's about himself. Mm-hmm. That's definitely everybody understands it. But I'm coming back to the issue which we did discuss. I'm coming back to the problems of his life, to the hardness of his life. We didn't know exactly what kind of price he paid to liberate himself. And what does it mean in reality of a human life to squeeze the slave out drop by drop? Only when you have all of the clouds in the blue sky, you would understand what kind of life he had and how really he did liberate himself. And the politics and politicians and all kind of issues of Russian life, he did understand it well. But he did understand also you need a distance, historical distance, you know, to liberate Russia. Not one man like Chekhov, but the whole country. Because, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of slavery. Russia was liberated from the serfdom in 1861. Chekhov was born a year before. He was born in 1860. Russia liberated from serfdom, just the beginning, a year later. The distance between slavery, serfdom, and the most liberated world writer is just a few decades. You know, you understand it in America probably more than we in Russia. You are a few decades from Martin Luther King, you know. Mm-hmm. Just a few decades ago. I'm not an American, but I read, you know. I was amazed. In the beginning of the 60s, somewhere in Los Angeles, I don't know, San Francisco, they did not allow to the black people to be in a bus together with the white. Mm-hmm. I could not imagine now in America. So it's just a few decades. Yes. It's a so short period of time when you trying to overcome it, to liberate yourself as a nation. It's the same with Russians.
So in some ways, Chekhov's life, 1860 to 1904, reflects what was going on in Russia generally.
Definitely. And I would say that Chekhov's life reflects also that Russia had another historical option. If Russia would go in the Chekhovian way of liberation, it would be a different country. We would not have the tragedy of this country in the 20th century, which is, you know,
the revolution under Stalin.
When the country, the nation actually, exterminated half of the nation by ourselves, not by the enemies, not by the enemies.
Well, again, interior struggle, a theme of Chekhov.
Exterminated ourselves. You cannot blame. Whom we should blame? Americans? Some of the idiots, Americans are against war. Even in the war against the fascism, Look at the figures. Germans, the fascists, 7 million of them were killed during the war. How many Russians were killed? 30 millions. This is the price. And Stalin did it, you know. On the end of the war in Berlin, it was not necessity, you know, to kill 300,000 of the Soviet soldiers just to take Berlin, because Stalin wanted to do it immediately. 300,000, okay. I ready to go. The price of a human life was zero for the whole century. And this is anti-Chekhovian trend. And did Chekhov feel it? I'm sure. Few months before his death in 1904, he died in July, he was asked by one of the Russian journalists, what do you feel about Russia, Russian future? And so he says, I don't know, I'm a writer. I'm not a fortune teller. And then I feel only the buzz. Russia is buzzing as a beehive. Russia is buzzing. He did not understand well where he's going, but the last stage direction of the Cherry Orchard, his last play, his last will, the last stage direction is so strange and so powerful. The sound of a breaking string afar. What does it mean, that sound of a break? It actually brings the whole shadow of the future. And everyone was struck, huh, why he ended his last play with that, you know, and then died? What does it mean, that sound of a breaking string? It means the whole experience of the 20th century in a noise. Actually, the great artists, they could not articulate it in the words. What I'm like animals. I feel that it's danger. It's a danger there. I have to leave.
More on the legacy of Anton Chekhov when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Anatoly Smelyansky from the Moscow Art Theater. We're talking about Chekhov, the great 19th century Russian playwright and short story writer. You mentioned that Chekhov celebrated sort of a drama in which nothing exactly happens in our traditional dueling, fight, grand, extreme action sort of sense. But I'm curious then, because you've seen many, many productions of Chekhov, you've directed them and so on, what are some of the favorite moments from Chekhov's plays that you have, the way we might, for example, with Shakespeare, have the Lady Macbeth washing the blood off her hands moment, or, you know, these moments in plays that stand out? And I'm curious, with the Chekhov plays that you've seen and worked with, such as Cherry Orchard or Three Sisters, Uncle Vanya, Seagull, what are some moments that you just can't wait to see on stage?
I would tell you about two moments of the Three Sisters. You know, the content of Chekhov now, like content of Shakespeare, is a combination of Shakespeare himself, Chekhov himself, and all of the interpretations of Shakespeare and Chekhov during the history, because we cannot separate the meaning which the great directors and actors gave to Chekhov and the meaning which you can get from Chekhov's play text. So I saw many, many, many productions, sometimes great productions of Chekhov. Look, two things which impressed me. It's 1967, Moscow, theater of Малая Бронная. Director is Anatoly Efres, one of the greatest directors of post-war Russia. The Three Sisters, which were ruined by the censorship, which is very rare case. Where is Chekhov, where is the Three Sisters, where is the Soviet censor? They ruined because the performance was... The mood of the whole play was, for them, it's a year before the Soviet tanks came to Prague. It's very interesting how Efres marked with the Three Sisters that life, which is unbearable, and something would happen. Because the mood of the Three Sisters is quite gloomy, you know. There is no way out to Moscow, nobody would come to Moscow, but they are dreaming and so on. There is a doctor, Chebutykin, there. Actually, in every Chekhov's play is a doctor. You know, that's a lyrical part of his... But Cherry Orchard. The only play where you could not find a doctor is the Cherry Orchard. Actually, this is the confirmation. This is the last play. He sees the world without him. All of the plays have a doctor. So in The Three Sisters is Dr. Chebutykin, who is a drunkard, an alcoholic, and complete cynicist, and so on and so on. But very beautiful man at the same time. He's Chekhovian, you know. He's coming in the third act after the surgery, washed his hand, cleaned it up, and he's drunk, completely drunk. And he started his one of the most beautiful monologues in Chekhov's plays about life and human being. And he's talking about, I just, you know, the patient died under my hand. I made a mistake, so I forgot everything. I'm not a doctor. And so I was in a club, and someone asked me, have I read Shakespeare or Schiller? And I put look on my face that I did read, but I never read it, and so on and so on. There is a monologue about life, and what is the look, and what is the reality. So, and it was in 1967, I would like to remind you. And that actor, great comedian, Lev Durov, the director put him on the sofa, and there is a gramophone, And before he starts that monologue about, they ask me about, have I read? And the patient died. He put on the gramophone and the music of the beginning of the century, kind of a, you know, twist, you know, of that. And he put on the knees, the Jabotinsky, and he started on sofa jumping like in a circus, jumping like a marionette, like an invalid without legs. He started jumping, producing that monologue about human life, and unbelievable for the rest of my life. That kind of marionette in Chekhov, you know, actually, I never saw it in that fantastic, grotesque way of expressing the human grief, the human despair. Another thing which is interesting in Chekhov, in some of his inventions, dramatic inventions, small improvements, I don't know how to say it. I saw many times Three Sisters in my life. Every time when in the beginning of the play, the officers are coming to visit Prozorov's house because of the birthday of the youngest of Irina, everyone has a gift and so on. And a young officer brings a top. And every time I saw, I don't know, 50 times Three Sisters in my life, every time in all of the countries, doesn't matter, America, Russia, Armenia, or France, every time when they started all of their birthday guests, you know, when one of them started, you know, pumping up the top, and the top is spinning about half of a minute, and then collapses. It takes, I don't know, half of a minute. In all over the countries, all over the world, those moments are full of incredible silence. The heroes of Chekhov's play, together with the audience, look at the top, how it's collapsing, how it starts, great start, you know, spinning, and collapses. He invented that. You know, you can use another toy. And he uses just the top, probably kind of a philosophical metaphor of his point of view. What is the human life? How it's fragile, how it's short. How it's, you know, starts with a great belief, you know, like all of his plays, starts in the spring, ends in the fall.
You mentioned censorship. Over the years since Chekhov, how have the various authorities in Russia handled his plays, his words?
It's a part of the bigger question, the response of the future of the 20th century to Chekhov. It's a big problem and big issue because immediately after the revolution, Chekhov was out of any favor. And the first post-revolutionary decade, officially, the Soviet censorship in the 20s, the censorship was, I would say, much more open than then in the Stalin time. And they published on the end of the 20s a special book to explain what play is good, what play is bad. All of the Chekhov's play, they marked with a B. B means A, B, you know. A is a good play from all point of view. B is not very good. And all Chekhov's plays, the Soviet censorship, marked openly without any discussion. B, because of what? Yes, it's a kind of a masterpiece, but insignificant social content from the social point of view. Who cares about Raneskaya and the guys who should, you know, sell the cherry orchard? The Soviets, we don't care about that. And or the officers in the Three Sisters. We killed all of those, you know, White Army officers. So the first response of the 20s was Chekhov is out of date. You know, we don't need him. Even the Moscow Art Theater was not allowed to play Chekhov. The house of Chekhov. And in the 30s, they allowed Chekhov to be performed and interpreted, but in a way of the whole Russian classics in the 30s. What they did, Stalin did deliberately. Yes, we love Russian classics. We would like Russian classics to be a part of the Soviet Empire. And because of that, yes, we will publish it. And they started publishing Chekhov and Leo Tolstoy. And they did not publish Dostoevsky. They were afraid of Dostoevsky because he's so, you know, angry with the revolutionaries, in his special novel, The Possessed, The Devils, and so on. But Tolstoy and Chekhov is in a great favor. But the favor was together with special instruction in the high school, first of all, because millions of people are in the high school, kids studying Chekhov. It was a special instruction, and a lot of Soviet scholars dedicated their life to kill Chekhov, to interpret him in a Soviet way. It's not about censorship, it's about interpretation. If I will talk to every kid in the country that all of the Chekhov's characters are in two camps, the heroes and parasites, you know. Who are the best people, of course, parasites, you know. Who is the hero? Peter Trofimov in the Cherry Orchard, young man, kind of a revolutionary, eternal student, and Anya, the most stupid young people, they are the heroes. All other are parasites. And for decades, they were trying to interpret Chekhov in that way. Then, after Stalin's death, this is the new epoch, new era, when the Russian theater, Soviet theater, got the chance to say something about Chekhov. Immediately, we got great scandals with Chekhov's interpretation, because Chekhov came back. It was a revelation. Chekhov can talk about everything, and actually he covers all of the Soviet issues. That's the problem. If you look at Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov and Russian classics and the Soviet censorship, the contradiction is, if you allow Chekhov to be printed or Tolstoy to be printed, do you expect that Chekhov will not affect anyone in the country? I did talk to Mikhail Gorbachev, who is a great friend of the Moscow Art Theater. And it was years ago when he was not a president, of course. And he said, you know, the gravest, the most important mistake of the Soviet system was when they in the 30s allowed Chekhov and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy to be printed be in every Soviet library. They did not expect and did not understand if you print Chekhov and Tolstoy, everyone is aware. Everyone knows what does it mean. And everyone can compare what you are doing and what is the real human life. And finally, they put, you know, the dynamite under, you know, the system. Because if you have Chekhov and you are free to go to the library to take and to read Three Sisters, you cannot take the Soviet regime forever. You cannot do it. That's the Gorbachev, I would say childish probably, naive, but very important remark. One of the mistakes of Stalin. Okay, we will establish the reputation of the Russian classics, but we will kill the meaning of them with army of high school teachers and university professors to take any kind of radiation from them. We have to make it clean, you know, from any kind of radiation. But they are radiate. You cannot kill it. And if you are able to read it, and that's the point. And Chekhov came back in the 50s, in the 60s, and actually the best portrayal of the Soviet life, even during the Brezhnev era, is the interpretation of Chekhov in the Soviet theater of the same time. And you could see and follow what was the real feeling of the nation, at least the best of people of the nation. You can see on stage, because they could not, you know, censorship is censorship of the words. You cannot censor, you know, the gesture of an actor. You cannot censor the silence, which is the fabric of Chekhov's play. They could not censor it. You cannot censor that.
Thank you for sharing your passion for Chekhov with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me to be here.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland. Our guest has been Anatoly Smelyansky from the Moscow Art Theater. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.